Good morning. It is a half a minute past 10 a.m. and you are tuned to KBOO Portland. Coming up, we'll hear an excerpt from Between the Lines Radio News Magazine because Air Cascadia is off today. At 10:15 on Locus Focus, host Barbara Bernstein speaks with Julia DeGraw of Food and Water Watch about Oregon Ballot Measure 92. They define GMOs and talk about why people have a right to know what's in their food. At 11 on Health Watch, host Dr. David Naiman speaks with herbalist Holly Bellenbuenos about her book, Women Healers of the World, The Traditions, History, and Geography of Herbal Medicine. And at 11:30, Jenka Soderberg interviews Alex Gates, a student at PSU and organizer in the PSU Student Union, about the administration's push for campus security to become a fully sworn police force. Thanks, KBOO, for listening. Thanks, KBOO, for listening to KBOO. Yeah, and thanks for your fantastic support in our recent membership drive. We couldn't do it without you. So, now do stay tuned for Between the Lines Radio after this message.
Tune in to KBOO on Wednesday, October 22nd at 6 p.m. for a spooky, spectacular radio show hosted on the KBOO Youth Collective. You'll hear pieces about haunted places, creepy animals, scary songs, and other things we find spooky and spectacular. That's Wednesday, October 22nd at 6 p.m. on your community station, KBOO Portland.
You better duck when I show up.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. First, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta is the world's first head of state to appear before the International Criminal Court in The Hague. Kenyatta, who was indicted 2 years ago for his role in post-election violence in 2007, was elected in 2013. He recently appeared before a status conference where prosecutors claimed the Kenyan government was withholding evidence in the war crimes case. The ICC indictment charges that Kenyatta organized mob violence in the Rift Valley, targeting political opponents following the disputed 2007 presidential election. Overall, 1,200 people were killed and over 600,000 were forced to flee their homes after then-President Mwai Kibaki, an ally of Kenyatta, was hurriedly inaugurated for a second and final term in office, despite claims by opposition candidate Raila Odinga that the result had been rigged. Kenyatta's lawyer, Stephen Kay, urged the ICC to drop the case. In December, an ICC panel stated, "It would be inappropriate for the prosecution to withdraw these charges at this stage in light of the Kenyan government's continuing failure to cooperate fully with the court's request for documents and records related to the charges." The prosecutor's case has been damaged by many witnesses' refusal to testify, growing frustration among victims of the 2007 violence, and the ICC's poor image in Africa. Back in 2010, gay rights activists in the conservative state of Utah expected a decades-long fight to legalize same-sex marriage. Instead, gay marriage is now the law of the land in Utah and many other socially conservative states after the U.S. Supreme Court declined to hear appeals of gay marriage rulings made by lower courts from the governors of Utah, Oklahoma, Indiana, Virginia, and Wisconsin. Recent rulings expanded the number of states that allow same-sex marriage to 30, along with the District of Columbia. Utah's same-sex marriage case, known as Kitchen v. Hebert, sought to overturn Amendment 3, which passed overwhelmingly in a 2004 statewide referendum that defined marriage as a union between a man and a woman. Prospects for repealing the law changed dramatically in 2013 when the U.S. Supreme Court overturned the Defense of Marriage Act. In Oklahoma, the Supreme Court ruling will mean the GOP-dominated state must drop gender requirements from marriage licenses. The 6th District Court of Appeals in Cincinnati is expected to issue a ruling soon on challenges to gay marriage bans in Michigan, Kentucky, Tennessee, and Ohio. Thus far, no federal appeals court has upheld a state's gay marriage ban. If the 6th District Court rules to support the ban, the Supreme Court may intervene and issue a declarative ruling on gay marriage that would set the standard in all 50 states. After running unsuccessfully for mayor in 2013, former city councilor Dan Samuels, now seeking election to the Minneapolis School Board, has attracted large donations from education reform groups backed by billionaires and hedge fund managers. Thus far, Samuels has raised 4 times the campaign funds collected by his main opponent, incumbent Rebecca Gagnon. According to the news magazine In These Times, Samuels has raised big bucks from California billionaire Arthur Rock, funneled through the 50 Can Action Fund. Rock also supports Leadership in Education Equity, the political action arm of Teach for America that advocates the expansion of charter schools. So what are out-of-state investors hoping to gain by helping Don Samuels get on the Minneapolis school board? The answer may lie in the well-documented billionaire-led push by education reform proponents to privatize the nation's public school system. This is often accomplished through the efforts to expand school choice through district and charter school competition, with the accompanying goals of weakening or eliminating both teachers' unions and democratically elected school boards. The infamous Koch brothers-funded American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, has also used its political muscle to push pro-charter bills through state legislatures across the country. This is all part of a pattern that's playing out in states including Texas, Oregon, Colorado, and New Jersey, where local school board races have been heavily influenced by the political and financial heft of outside anti-union education reform groups. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
In August, the U.S. Attorney for Manhattan, Preet Bharara, issued a report charging that the New York City Department of Correction had systematically violated the civil rights of young male prisoners 16 to 18 years old held at Rikers Island by failing to protect them from the rampant use of unnecessary and excessive force by abusive correction officers. The report described a deep-seated culture of violence against youthful inmates at the jail complex, perpetrated by guards who operated with little fear of punishment. It singled out for blame a powerful code of silence among the Rikers Island prison staff, along with a virtually useless system for investigating charges against guards made by inmates. The report found that the result was a staggering number of injuries among adolescent inmates. U.S. Attorney Bharara warned that if the city did not work cooperatively to develop new policies and procedures, the Justice Department could file a federal lawsuit asking a judge to order the imposition of remedies. On the date the report was issued, August 4th, Bharara gave the city 49 days to respond to the investigation's findings. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Josh Rovner, state advocacy associate with a sentencing project, who talks about the investigation and the larger problem of criminally charging teenagers as adults and taking a hard line on minor offenses.
The federal investigation reveals things that shock the conscience, but one would have to be blind to think that those abuses are unique to the 3 buildings that the U.S. Attorney's Office happened to investigate. They didn't even look at the girls' prisons. They found a deep-seated culture of violence. That's not the prisoners, that's the guards. And those guards had little fear of being punished.
New York is one of only 2 states that treat 16-year-olds as adults in the criminal justice system. What impact do you think that may have had on the level of violence directed against them?
New York State is one of just 2 states that treat everyone over 16 as an adult. North Carolina is the other. And I think it's important to get this exactly correct, because New York State says if you're accused of a crime at 16, you're an adult. But you're still a teenager when you apply for a driver's license, if you want to get married or buy alcohol or cigarettes. When it comes to the justice system, they're willing to make an exception. 16-year-olds are occasionally adults in New York State. All of the science disagrees with this view. Adolescent brains are still developing. Even teenagers who do make mistakes, though, have a capacity for reform.
Until a few years ago, Connecticut also considered 16 and 17-year-olds adults in the criminal justice system. Do you have any comparative data on New York and Connecticut since the change?
Connecticut did raise the age back in 2007. They passed a law, and that went into effect on New Year's Day 2010. Connecticut joined the mainstream on that. And did their crime go up? No. juvenile arrest rates in Connecticut fell from 22,000 in 2008 to 13,000 in 2011. That's the last year for which there's data, and that's a 41% drop. Let's compare that to New York State. 2008, there were 102,000 arrests. 2011, 120,000 arrests of juveniles. That's an 18% increase. Being tough on crime doesn't work. These are federal counts, and so these are everyone, they count juveniles as being 10 to 17 years old. So whether the state is treating juveniles as juveniles, they are still counted under the federal data.
So the U.S. Attorney's Office issued a report, and the New York Times also did an expose on the issue.
I think what is so awful about this study is that we discovered that the data that was available is completely inadequate. The teenagers were afraid to report what was happening. The New York Times, in their additional study, found that corrections officials had sanitized the data. I mean, that's a polite way to say that they lied, that the abuses and fights and beatings were even worse. The teenagers don't report the abuse for fear of retribution. So the data that we have is incomplete. The federal report issues 80 recommendations. I think the most important is removing teenagers entirely from Rikers. That system is broken for juveniles.
Josh Rovner, does the government report suggest where these teens should be held?
They ought to be in community-based programs closer to home. The New Yorker had this remarkable piece about Caleb Browder. 16 years old, he was being investigated for stealing a backpack. The police said he stole it. Caleb said he didn't. I mean, this is what we have courts for. And he sat at Rikers for 3 years because of a backlog of cases. You know, the question of whether we need to be locking up low-level offenders in the first place is a key question.
What other of the 86 recommendations do you think are the most important?
You know, they also recommended taking teenagers out of solitary confinement, which is something that all the adolescent development experts would agree with as well. Mayor de Blasio announced, in fact, they are going to end solitary confinement for teenagers there as of December 31st. When the announcement was made, there were 51 teenagers in solitary confinement at Rikers. Kids can be put into solitary confinement for things like horseplay and talking back and having more clothing than they're entitled to there. It was something that was completely being abused. One thing I find very interesting in all of this is that the mayor's office has said that this change to solitary confinement was not in response to the report. I'm really wondering when it is that the mayor is going to respond to this report. There was a deadline of late September. We are now about 2 weeks past that deadline. Has anyone been fired, disciplined, reassigned? The mayor's office hasn't said so. And even worse, warden and deputy warden of the facility have been promoted. It's an outrage. When you have a broken system and you're looking at that many recommendations, there's a lot to be done. It really starts with moving kids out of the facility and not locking up lower-level offenders in the first place.
That was Josh Rovner, State Advocacy Associate with the Sentencing Project. Find more perspectives on the abuse of adolescent inmates inside the nation's juvenile justice system by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
This is Sun Lee, KBOO's Membership Director. Thank you to everyone who called in during our fall membership drive. With your amazing support, we reached our $80,000 goal. We would also like to thank all of our volunteers for doing a great job and for making KBOO a great community and radio station. And thank you to all of the restaurants that provided food. For more information on them, visit kboo.fm/food. We are proud to be your radio station and honored to have your support this fall membership drive. Thank you.
This is Rita Christie, host of the Noontime Jamboree on the first and third Monday of each month. Please join me for vintage jazz, country, and western swing. That's on the Noontime Jamboree, the first and third Mondays from noon until 2 p.m. right here on KBOO.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.